Working smarter is the key to success as an entrepreneur in 2022. That is why I've partnered with Sage. Sage is the trusted global provider of finance, HR, and payroll software to help small and medium businesses like me and you thrive. To learn more about Sage, go to sage.com or click the link in the pod description.
Building a company in order to be acquired is a terrible idea, but keeping your options open and being aware of the different paths you could follow, you're either going to, you know, IPO, be acquired, you know, have a PE exit, or fail. Ride all the different horses at once and see which one looks the best in any given time, basically.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. This podcast helps you achieve your goals by sharing what I'm doing to reach my potential as an entrepreneur. Over the next 60 minutes, you will learn strategies, tips, and lessons to build a world-class business. Each week, I seek out a new mentor on my quest to become the ultimate entrepreneur. And this week, I'm chatting to Mark Cummins, who has built and sold two businesses and both to Google. Mark is a truly world-class entrepreneur, and he is exactly the pedigree of person and entrepreneur I had in mind when I started this podcast. Welcome to my chat with Mark Cummins, the founder of Pointy and Plink. Mark, welcome to the pod.
Gary, nice to be here.
Pleasure. You're literally just landed in the country.
Yeah, that's right. Off a plane yesterday, so slightly groggy, but hopefully still sharp enough to have a chat.
I'm sure we will. Anywhere exciting?
I was in the US yesterday, so I just came back from New York. I had a few meetings there and a conference, so yeah.
Nice. New York is just one of those cities for me anyway. Come back and you're like a kid when you're there looking up going, it's like a movie set. It's like an actual movie set.
It does have tremendous energy. Yeah, it does. I've never, I'd stayed in Brooklyn, which I've never been to before, and it's got a different vibe to the rest of New York. So it's like, my normal impression of New York is very angry and like everyone talks very fast, but that was a slightly more mellow side of New York, I felt. So it was nice to see it.
It's cool. It's an incredible city. I always just get such a buzz from in there. Brooklyn's really nice. Yeah. It's a little bit different, a little bit kind of, yeah, it's funny you say that actually. It's a kind of different vibe, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely a little more kind of, you know, just the slightly less intense version.
I reached out to you a couple of months ago because I spotted you just left your current role. So maybe just give us a high level overview of what you've been doing for the last kind of couple of years.
Yeah, so I guess going back to the very start, I mean, if you want my background, I did initially a PhD in robotics, or I'm like an engineer by trade. And I started a company based on that research in 2010. That became part of Google in the following year, actually. And so I worked at Google on computer vision for a couple of years, and then left Google in 2014, or actually late 2013, and started another company called Pointy, which was a sort of retail search data company, which we can talk about. And that ran that until 2020, when Google basically also acquired that Pointy. And then I was at Google until just a few months ago, and sort of betting in Pointy, and like, you know, a lot of my colleagues are still there, but I've just moved on, and I've actually just taken the last 2 or 3 months out and thinking about what to do next.
We have a lot to unpack there. Your first company, you sold it within did I hear you correctly? You sold it the following year after starting it.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a funny one because I was doing it was sort of in parallel with my PhD. And so like it's kind of hard to pinpoint exactly like when I started, because I kind of like faded into it a bit. But yeah, it was definitely less than a year of full time when the company was acquired. Yeah.
How does that happen?
Yeah, it's quite the first one was a bit unusual. Like it wasn't probably a typical journey in that we were commercializing some technology that myself and my co-founder had developed during our PhDs. So even though the company was relatively young, like the technology that it was using was based on like, you know, many years of research, and we had like a very you know, fairly unique and well established piece of tech, basically. And so when the company started, we could, you know, from day one, we could do some, you know, pretty impressive tech demos. So what we were working on was search with an image. So, I'm sure people have seen it by now, where like you take a photo of something or you upload a photo to Google and you can get back search results based on the content of the image. And so that was something that we both worked on. And so we were kind of commercializing that. And so, yeah, we developed some Android apps around it. This was like very early on when the iPhone, I think, had only been released like the previous year. Certainly the first Android phone came out that year. And so we made a little bit of a splash, I guess. We were one of the first featured apps on the Android market. And we started to get, I think we got 50 or 60,000 users in our first month, which was wow. pretty good for those days. Mm-hmm. And so like we kind of just kind of attracted attention quite quickly. And, I guess we came to Google's notice and we started talking to them, and they had an internal team working. It turned out they hadn't really announced anything. We didn't know they were working on it, but they had an internal team working on something very similar. And so we kind of got to know that team. And in the end, like they pretty quickly made us an offer. And, while we were still a young company, we hadn't even taken any investment at that point. So, myself and my co-founder had a long discussion about it. It was actually a difficult decision about, because we were right in the early days of the company, and like, do you want to end the journey that quickly? But ultimately, we kind of just balanced everything up and decided it was the right move. And so, we were a tiny company at the first time around, like a 2-person company basically. So wow. It was a short sharp journey, but a lot of learning, a lot of accelerated learning, I'd say, in that one.
Talk to me about that, because you said something interesting there about it was actually a difficult decision. I think when people think of, if Google wanted to buy my company, I'd be so happy. Talk to me about that decision-making process. What was that like?
Yeah, well, it's complicated because, you're just at the start of something. You can see it sort of starting to gain traction. Like I said, we really had this great initial response from users, and, you're kind of projecting ahead into the future about where you might be. And then you're kind of thinking, do I want to take an acquisition now or not? And it was also a complicated personal decision, because we had to move. I was actually in Oxford at the time doing my PhD. So, and we had to, as part of the acquisition, move to California. And, we both had relationships. We're like, do we want to be in long distance relationships? Like, so it was almost like there were four decision makers. It wasn't just myself and my co-founder. It was also our partners. And we were kind of, you were also trying to weigh up those kind of factors. So, it's not an easy thing to weigh up. You're trying to, think about the probabilities of all the different outcomes, I guess. But in the end, I think, in retrospect, I think we definitely made the right decision, because we were very early on in the kind of maturity of like machine learning and computer vision. And, that market is still, I would say, very concentrated inside the larger companies. And we didn't know that at the time, but like, I think it probably was the right thing to do I think some of the bigger companies have a natural advantage in some of that stuff, because they have, the scale, the reach, the data. And so working on it internally turned out to be probably the right path. And it was definitely rewarding for us. We got to see our tech sort of deployed to, I guess, billions of users at this point. So it wasn't an easy decision, but I think retrospect, probably the right one.
Yeah, I like when people talk about it, because it seems so surface level when it's announced, kind of going, so-and-so's bought by whoever. You don't think of the partners and the decisions and the emotional aspect of that. You just see the headline going, oh, good for them.
Yeah, I mean, like Facebook, for example, like, Mark Zuckerberg famously turned down $1 billion acquisition, and he had a board meeting apparently where he said, this is just a formality. Of course, we're not going to take $1 billion offer. And, apparently the whole management team resigned, right? And you had to sort of build again. But that, in retrospect, that was, he was completely right, So having the courage of your convictions can be hard in those situations. But yeah.
What was it like then as a founder? Massive change. You were just probably found your feet as a founder, and now you're going the other side of the world, and you're getting kind of sucked into the big machine. What was that like?
It's an adjustment. I mean, I'd never, I guess, had a proper job in a sense before that. Like, I'd had whatever summer jobs, and I'd had, I was a PhD student, but I'd never actually worked in a big company. I think the period of running a startup, like, you have very, very quick learning, because you know, you're the CEO of a two-person company, but when you do business with another company, they're like, oh, you're the CEO. We should meet at like CEO level or something, right? So you get this sort of massive career jump. And so I think that was very, very valuable. But then coming into a big organization, you're obviously, you know, you're part of a much bigger machine. You're kind of like, you know, one cog in the giant overall machine. And so it was, I mean, some people find that a tough transition. I didn't really. I mean, because the journey was like, you know, I was still fairly young. I learned a lot there. You know, I learned a lot about how to, you know, run a good engineering organization, what a good, you know, culture looked like. Google in 2010 was still a relatively young company, and I think it did a lot of things right. And so I enjoyed the experience. And as an engineer, it was just nice to see our technology kind of scaled out to this very big audience, and we had bigger resources to work with. So it was a very positive experience for me, definitely that one.
What's it like when you sell your company? Because people talk about the financial rewards, and I'm sure, obviously we can't reveal that, but I'm sure it was a sum. Does it change your motivation at all? Do you kind of go, oh, that's great, now I have that? Or does it just give you a comfort blanket to then go explore on a bigger level?
It's obviously transformative in some ways. Like, you know, I you could do things that, you know, you have a different level of freedom, I guess. I mean, like one thing I started to do was angel invest in other startups, which, you know, obviously I was a PhD student before that. And my PhD stipend was like, I think, 12,000 a year or something. Like, you know, it was very, very minimal. And all of a sudden I kind of had, you know, definitely a big safety net and, you know, salary of a Google engineer or something. So it was a huge financial shift. I tried very hard to ignore it actually for a while. Like, you know, I'd kind of not really kind of change my lifestyle very much. But, you know, over time, you know, it does allow you to do extra stuff. But the investing side of things was actually pretty useful later on. So I started to invest in other startups, and, you know, obviously, you know, investing can have financial, you know, upside as well. But what was particularly useful was that I got to see, you know, how all these other companies worked, you know, because I'd, you know, be an investor and I get their updates, their monthly updates or whatever. I kind of see how those situations evolved later on. Like, you know, some of the companies raised later rounds, or some of the companies like didn't succeed. And, you know, that perspective that I got into, like, a, you know, I don't know, 10, 15 companies, I don't know what the number was, but it was enough to kind of have a sample of how, you know, how it works. And also see it from the investor side of the table, where when I was later running Pointy and raising money, I kind of really understood, you know, the what the people on the other side of the table were thinking, and, you know, how things might play out for us, and like what the good companies had done and the bad ones, you know, kind of you begin to pattern match a bit like that. So that was very valuable, actually. And that was sort of unlocked, I think, by the first exit.
That's really interesting point, actually, because then you'd seen it from all three sides. You'd seen it from the founder, the investor, and the employee side going into Google. So you get a full 360 view. What pull out some lessons for me about being an angel investor, because I think there's probably huge learnings you took from that, like you said, into your future company. So what were the key things you learned as an angel investor?
I mean, a lot of it is sort of pattern matching. That's maybe harder to put into to like a few pithy phrases. I mean, what stands out? I mean, the first thing is that it's extremely humbling, right? You know, you make all these investments with high conviction, and I know kind of rationally the statistics are like 1 in 10 startups succeed or whatever, but you kind of think, well, these ones all seem really good.
Like, yeah, yeah, I'm different.
I know a bit about startups, so. But then you find that you're just the same, right? You know, so it's humbling, and like, you know, stuff goes wrong. There's a lot of luck. It's just irreducible, I think, you know. So that's the first thing. The second one is, I mean, I suppose what's characteristic of the better companies, I don't know if I can really put this into words, but like you can see the sort of energy in their update emails. Like, actually, the speed at which people reply to an email is incredibly predictive of their future success. It's amazing. Like, I've heard this from other places too. Like, you know, just how quickly, how engaged people are is very, it just seems very telling. Even if you say this to people, it's the ones who are really on top of things, does seem to sort of translate into everything. You know, they're the obvious ones that, like, you have to be in a large market. You know, you have to have a good team. You know, you have to not compromise on the quality of the team. I've seen companies go wrong where they get the wrong investors involved, where the investors can be a negative force. You know, you can have bad board dynamics, all sorts of things. So you just build up this sort of whole sort of repertoire of all the different pitfalls.
Muscle memory almost. Was there ever a situation where you were involved as an investor and you could just see it starting to go off the rails? Did you ever feel kind of out of control when you're as an investor? Because as an entrepreneur, you're like, okay, we can do this now. Let's just change direction. But as an investor, I'm sure you're kind of on the train and you're just like following a track.
Yeah. I mean, as an investor, it's not your role to be kind of, you know, trying to steer the ship, right? You're a passenger, basically. I mean, you can maybe make a suggestion here and there, but yeah, there were times where, you know, companies I was an investor in went wrong, and oftentimes there's nothing you can do about it other than just try and, you know, support the founders and like, you know, tell them, like, I always say, basically, no hard feelings. If you want to go again, like, you know, please go again, you know, and I would not, you know, you sometimes see investors get like aggrieved, and I think that's just, you know, it's the wrong attitude. You know, people try and they try again and things don't always work out. And most people behave ethically, and you just sort of, you know, it's a tough time and you just hope that they get through it as best they can. And often the circumstances are not, you know, people fight hard and sometimes it doesn't work, you know, for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah, external factors or something beyond your control. When did you leave Google then the first time?
So it was summer 2013.
Okay. And was that to pursue something else, or was that to kind of, you know, I've done my time when I explore new things?
Yeah, I was at that point explicitly thinking about doing another company. I actually didn't know what. I had maybe two sort of semi-serious ideas and I was kind of kicking the tires on them. I did know that I wanted to do another startup, which kind of surprised me, because the first time around, I was like, well, that was, you know, short but very intense. And I'm not sure I, you know, have it in me to do it again. And then, you know, a few years later, I was like, well, actually, I do want to do it again. And so, yeah, I had two specific ideas that I was kind of kicking the tires on, one of which is pointy. The other was something totally, totally different. And
do you still have that in the back pocket for later?
Yeah, I just tried to explore them by... I wanted to do, I was thinking about robotics for logistics. So like totally, totally different. And I kind of concluded that one was a bit premature, and I think probably even still might be, you know, it's just on the cusp. But yeah, I started to kind of explore those by talking to, you know, just trying to think through all the different ingredients of the startup, you know, think about how much money would we need to raise? You know, like what do customers think of the idea? Just go in and I was just, you know, go into shops and just find a quiet time and sort of say, can I ask you some weird questions and see what they think about the idea? And, you know, when I was thinking about the robotics logistics ones, I used to kind of go I was thinking about doing it in supermarkets. So I used to go to supermarkets at like 11 o'clock at night and watch them restocking the shelves and think about how we could do it. And, you know, so just kind of gathering information, talking to people, talking to potential co-founders, investors, just sort of feeling my way into it, really.
Where did that idea come from? Because they're quite different, right? And they're different again to what you've done before. Where did those ideas spark from?
I mean, I suppose this is something I've always done, that I always, like, I have probably a book of 20, 30, 40 startup ideas where, you know, whenever I kind of encounter a problem that I think, oh, why is this way? How could that be different? And, you know, you just sort of collect them, and some of them are bad, you know? I mean, some of them just stay in the book and get crossed out, but some of them think, well, actually, why is this like this? So the genesis of Pointy, I mean, there's a couple of elements. One of them is, you know, I was at Google working on search, right? So, you know, search with an image. And I kind of thought, you know, this search with an image thing, it's very technically impressive, but it's not like something I need to use all that often. I mean, maybe it is getting now at the point where you would use it more often because it's really getting better. But at the time I was thinking, well, like, you know, there are probably much more basic questions that you can't answer with a search. And one of the really basic ones is like, where can I buy X, you know, which local store has, you know, whatever, an umbrella, a blender, a hockey stick currently in stock. And I was thinking, how could we solve that problem? So I just started to think about it. And that sort of basically led to Pointy. So I was thinking about it from the consumer point of view, how do we solve the problem? And that led me into thinking about all the different sort of technical mechanisms and, you know, all the the details of the company in terms of you know, how we would scale it, how we would fund it, you know, et cetera.
That's a giant problem. Where do you even start with a problem like that?
Well, I mean, I like to think of companies a bit like, you know, Fermi problems. You've probably heard the term, where you think of, like, you know, there's these questions of, like, you know, how many ping pong balls does it take to fill a double-decker bus or something, right? Where you just think about, like, on the back of a piece of paper, like, you know, the kind of questions I'd be thinking about is, well, like, you know, how many retailers are there in, you know, in the country? You know, what kind of, you know, how do we get the data from them? You know, how would we find consumers to get the data? How many salespeople would we need to, you know, what would the cost of acquiring a customer be, you know? And you can actually get very far on those questions with a blank sheet of paper in an empty room, just sort of estimating them. I've told the story before, but I was actually, when I had this 3 month period after I left Google, but before I started Pointy, one of the things I did was I crossed the Pacific on a ship. And I did a lot of the kind of initial estimates for Pointy in a cabin on the ship with no access to the internet.
What kind of ship? I need to know more about this.
Work. I couldn't get any of the data. I wanted to go on a container ship, actually, but I couldn't do it. So I ended up going on a cruise ship with a lot of elderly Australians.
I had this idea. I said this to my wife a while ago. I was like, do you know what I'd love to do? I'd just love to go across the ocean on just a big container ship just to do it. And she was like, you need new hobbies.
Yeah.
So how did you do? Because I read years ago about a guy, I think he sailed all around the world in a container ship, and he blogged it, and he did a like blog about it. But I was like, that'd be such an incredible thing. So you had the same idea and you ended up on a cruise ship.
I ended up on a cruise ship, yeah, which wasn't my plan, but that's what I did. And it was a unique kind of experience. And but at the same time, it gave me lots of time to think. And so that was one of the things I did. And yeah, it's amazing how far you can get, basically, you know, without, I think it's probably a good thing, actually, to have no distractions, no internet, nothing.
Definitely.
And just sort of think through the problem. And you can actually get quite far like that. I mean, it's, I don't really believe in business plans, but I do believe in sort of thinking through, you know, all the different levers of the company, basically. You know, how much capital are we going to need? How big, you know, how much headcount are we going to need, you know? And you can work those things out. They look very different for different businesses, right? You know, different businesses have different drivers. So, yeah.
I also like the fact that this was a new industry. Again, I think people get a bit scared and some people kind of scoff at people going into a new industry. Sure, what do you know about X industry? I think it can bring a freshness. And exactly like you said, a blank sheet of paper and a fresh perspective can get you a lot of ways in terms of, well, this is how we've always done it. You don't fall into that trap.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can't, like, for, you know, it's almost the naivety can be an advantage, right? You know, a lot of people with more knowledge would say, oh, this is not going to work for X or Y reason. But sometimes, you know, I think you get the innovation coming from outside often because the naivety can help. You know, you don't know how difficult it's going to be. And sometimes if you really knew, you might not have ever started. So,
So where did you step off the ship?
So I was actually in Australia.
Yeah. Okay. So you stepped off the ship in Australia. The blank sheet of paper is now no longer blank. What are we doing next?
So yeah, I kind of came to the conclusion this was the right idea. And so then started just trying to, well, the first thing I wanted to do was recruit, find a co-founder for the business. And so I was trying to figure out, you know, does one other person in the world think this is a good idea? If you can convince one other person, then maybe that's a signal that you're not totally mad. One of the aspects of the business was that we needed to design a hardware device, like a physical thing that would go into the shops and help with the data collection. And so I rang up a friend from my PhD in Oxford, a guy called Charles Bibby, who became co-founder. And I actually didn't think Charles would be available to do it because he was also on a boat at the time. We have a very nautical story. Well, 3 months prior, he basically quit his job, sold all his possessions, bought a boat, and went on a two-year sailing trip around the Mediterranean with his fiance. He like proposed on the way out of the harbor, and they were on this kind of like honeymoon or whatever kind of honeymoon. Trip together.
This guy's got style. I already like Charles. I like this.
Charles is about 3 months into this. Yeah, Charles has got great style. And so Charles was a hardware engineer, and I thought he could actually give me a recommendation for somebody I could work with, because I thought, you know, there's no way he's available because he's just committed to this, you know, once in a lifetime adventure. And but I rang him up and said, you know, hey, what do you think? And he actually got really excited about the idea, and he was saying, well, maybe I could be the co-founder. So he had a long heart-to-heart with his fiance, and they decided to abandon their dream trip. They were about three months into it, and he turned the boat around and sailed it back to Ireland, which was a big decision, obviously. And,
not quite Nice or Saint-Tropez. Sorry, we're having a quick detour Skerries.
Yeah, and he actually lived on this boat for almost all of Pointy.
No way. Where did he live in it?
In Malahide Marina.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And first version of the Pointy hardware, he wanted to test, you know, just sanity check, would the idea work? So he actually made the first version of the Pointy hardware on his boat at anchor off Mallorca. So he had to get someone to fly down with a bag full of oscilloscopes and soldering irons. And he made this prototype while actually, you know, rocking about. So it was pretty difficult, but it worked. And he thought, okay, this has legs, so let's do it. And so that's how we started.
What a story. We're nearly 200 episodes in, and I'm struggling to think of a better origin story than that one. Quick question on that one.
Yeah, I nearly
got lost in the romanticism of Charles's story there. You automatically went for a co-founder. Why?
I mean, I think it's essential. I mean, I know a lot of people, you know, do as a solo founder, and it works very well for them. But my first business, I had a co-founder. I found it was just, you know, you refine each other's ideas very much. You know, sometimes I'd be too eager and he'd pull me back. Sometimes the opposite. You know, I think it's very, very useful to have somebody there to you both sharpen each other, and you're both kind of emotional support for each other as well. You know, you kind of, you know, smooth out the highs and the lows by having two people. And it just gives strength, accountability, creativity, like everything. Like a good co-founder is, you know, really makes things way better, in my opinion. And you can share the load. Like, you know, if one of you is sick or something, right, you know, someone else can hold the fort. So I think in my experience anyway, two heads is much better than one.
You've worked now twice successfully with co-founders, and this is often a struggle founders have, just that relationship. What are your traits, or what are your good working hygiene rules for having a good relationship with a co-founder?
I mean, it needs to be someone that you really know and trust. Like, I wouldn't dream of doing it with someone that I just met or had some kind of, you know, co-founder speed dating or something. Like, some people do and it works for them, but I mean, the people I've done it with are people that I would have known for years, you know, would have, you know, really known their working style, known them, you know, socially, you know, knew that we get on. Because you're going to be tested, that relationship is going to be tested like really hard, right? You're going to have every conceivable crisis basically in a company that goes the distance. So it really has to be a strong relationship. You know, factors that I would personally look for, I think, you know, just someone who's kind of a level-headed person, you know, cool kind of, but you know, so other people work different with a different type of person. It might be someone who's a bit more mercurial and creative. Like, you know, it's just finding the right match for you. I think a little bit of a difference in, you know, you're going to complement each other a little bit. I mean, I think one thing I think of is that most relationships have like a spring and a damper, if you like. So, you know, the spring is something that like gives energy, you know, but if it's all spring, you know, the system just oscillates back and forth. You like hair off in one direction and then end up coming back. Whereas the damper kind of slows things down, but if it's all damper, you don't go anywhere. So the combination of a kind of a spring and a damper gives you a kind of a system that, it's a very engineering metaphor, but it gives you a system that kind of behaves nicely. And so I think, you know, you always have somebody who plays those two roles. The other one is the kind of like long-term, short-term trade-off. I'm a very long-termist kind of view, and Charles would sometimes be a bit more short-termist. So he'd say like, you know, I'd say like, this is where we need to be a year from now. It's like, don't worry about a year from now. This is where we have to be a week from now. And those two things also are complementary strengths and weaknesses. And I think, you know, having those two balances balance out actually gives you the best result.
That's a super, super analogy, a spring and a damper. I've definitely never had that one before. When you decided to go again, what was different this time? What did you learn from the first time to bring it into to Pointy when you were like, right, this is what we're doing day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What was new about Pointy that you were going to do differently?
Okay. So I definitely learned from being, like I said, from being an angel investor, I'd learned a lot more about, you know, how the investment side of things work and like the milestones that we'd need to hit, like the shape the company would need to have. Like, what do we need to do to raise a seed round? What do we need to do to raise a Series A? What does a good term sheet look like? You know, where should we bargain hard, and when, you know, when is a deal good enough? So I learned a lot about that. Also from working at Google, I learned quite a lot about what a good engineering culture looks like in terms of, you know, what's a good engineer, you know, what's good in terms of, you know, code reviews and testing, and like, when should you be judicious about some of that stuff and, you know, say, okay, we're a very early startup, we don't have to do X, but we really need to do Y, you know? So that stuff I'd learned a lot about. Other stuff I was still completely, you know, green and naive, like, you know, building a sales team, I knew nothing about. And so we had to learn that as we went along, you know, sales, marketing, you know, what does the CFO do? Like, I have no idea. So let's figure this out, you know? So a lot of those things you still work out along the way. You're never going to know everything, and that's okay.
I like that. There's definitely a humbleness to that. I do admire when people are openly admit that, even though you've had a massive exit and you've gone and worked at Google. I like that you're able to, I think that's a sign of a great entrepreneur as well. So what was your first kind of milestone then? What did you have to do first? Because as far as I understand, you had to actually build a product for Pointy.
Yeah, so we had to build a hardware device, right? So for people who don't know, we were collecting basically inventory data from local retailers and putting it online so you could see the live inventory of stores. And the way we initially did that was a hardware device that would basically connect to the point of sale and stream the inventory information to our server so we could put it online. And later on, we had software integrations to the point of sales as well, but that came later. And, you know, building hardware is difficult, right? You know, it's like, it's very unforgiving. It's not like software where there's, you know, there's a bug and you can ship the next release a day later. Hardware, like, you know, you've got a factory there and, you know, you have to, you know, if the circuit board is wrong, like the iteration time can take, you know, months sometimes. So for the initial prototypes, I mean, our first milestone was basically raising the seed round. So we raised just over like 1.2 million, I think, in the seed round. And that was about, you know, that was in late 2014, early 2015, when the company was, I mean, I'd kind of been working on it for about a year, but like really, I mean, a lot of that was just sort of kicking the tires. We'd kind of been going properly for maybe less than 6 months at that point. And so we just needed to get a basic prototype, enough to kind of basically prove that we had something there that customers wanted and something we could show to investors. So we jury-rigged basically the initial version of the system, where it was nothing like the final product. Like we hadn't got our own sort of circuit boards or anything like that. We kind of had a few off-the-shelf things that we could cobble together into something that more or less did the job, basically. And we just deployed it with an initial set of trial customers. So the very first customer, actually, we had our first investor pitch meeting lined up for the Friday, and we had agreed to deploy it in the first customer, I think, on the Wednesday or Thursday. So just 2 days before, because, you know, we were trying to race to get everything ready, and we had enough of the software working. And we had a friendly retailer who was, you know, a friend of a friend, who'd agreed to let us put it in their shop. And we turned up on, yeah, the Thursday, I think, and it turned out their system was incompatible. So the early version of our hardware only worked with certain points of sale. And we had this crisis. We're like, oh, we're meant to meet all the investors tomorrow, and we have nothing to show them. So I ended up just walking into another shop, Donnybrook Bikes, and just pitching them cold and saying, look, we have this. I didn't tell them anything about, you know, you're our first customer or anything. I said, here's our, you know, idea, and would you like to use it? And miraculously, they said yes. And, you know, we had to attach hardware to their point of sale. So it's pretty scary, you know, like it sounds like a scam or something.
A lot of trust going on yes, there. Yeah,
and
a lot
that of trust. Was our first. Yes, it was amazing. It was a good, I mean, fair juice to them. They took a huge gamble on us, and I think they're still a user now. I don't know how many, what's this, about 8 years later or something now. Yeah, they took a gamble on us. You know, the system worked, and we could show it then to some investors the next day. I was flying to London, so we were meeting investors in London. And I think that was a good sign, like, you know, where if we got some, at least a few retailers willing to say yes, that sort of gave us some confidence that, okay, maybe this will work.
You get that magical traction slide.
Exactly. Yeah. One from zero to one. But we then rolled out to, I think, about a dozen or, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20, maybe 10 and 20 retailers. And we stayed there for maybe 3 months or more, just sort of like, you know, working out. Because a lot of things you can't test until you have actual users. Mm. You can't predict, you know, what they're going to do, where the issue is going to be. And you know, what do they like and what do they not like? And so we sort of stayed in that phase of just like, you know, beta testing or even alpha testing with that initial customer base, and got a lot of learnings out of that. And then that helped us design our first product. And then probably about 6 months later, about 6 months later, we were able to kind of, you know, nail down a sort of a V1 that was ready for scaling. And then we kind of went out to scale it with an actual salesperson and, you know, grow it from there.
I popped on Twitter that you were going to come on, and you've kind of half answered it there, but we'll ask again. Just Paul O'Shea from Peckish, he tweeted me saying, "We'd love to know more about the initial onboarding with retailers at the beginning, how that integration worked and what they needed to change in their operations in order to scale that out from there."
Yeah, so I suppose I have kind of given a bit of a sketch. I can give a bit more detail. So like I said, we had this very sort of, you know, basic version of the product held together with string and sealing wax. And a lot of the functionality that would later exist wasn't there. So, you know, there was crucial bits of like data review that like, you know, not data review, like a kind of product data was something that we had to put into the system. And like that was all still being done by hand. I remember sort of trying to do it on a train in the UK, like manually typing stuff in, you know, behind the scenes. It was something that appeared automatic to the user. Like, you know, a lot of it wasn't built fully. And that would be typical, I think, of a lot of startups, right? You kind of, you know, just try and do the minimum possible to get something out there and make it, you know, get some customer feedback. So it was very basic. You know, but it worked well enough to kind of test the idea and see what would happen. And then when we wanted to properly kind of scale it, you know, we were pretty scrappy. Again, we hired one salesperson. I can talk about that process if you like. We kind of had, we did the customer support ourselves, just like from the founding team. And the guy who was basically our COO just was answering emails. So like, you know, we were, I don't know, five people in a room or something at that point. So, you know, everything was kind of fairly basic. But when we started doing the test sales, it started to work. Basically, we could see that the retailers were adopting us. And so then we just set ourselves some growth targets. I think we targeted about 7% per week. So 7% week over week growth of customers. And we maintained that for, you know, a year or so, which when you're starting from, you know, 10 retailers, you know, that's only going from 10 users to 300 or something over the course of a year. But still, like, you know, it kind of imposes a discipline on the company at that point where you said, okay, now we're in growth mode and we're going to, you know, try and keep those numbers on track. And that's actually very important for investors. You can kind of show these nice sort of slides showing, you know, here our user numbers increasing along this kind of predictable curve. And that's that really was actually pretty important to how we raise money later.
I think that's a really good lesson, though. Have some metric. Have something that you're going, because sometimes I think as an early stage, you know, you're just happy to survive. You're like, oh, we're getting there. But I think even the 7%, just have some sort of metric and up and to the right. You know what they say? As long as it's going up and to the right, investors will be happy. Right. Team will be happy.
We didn't do that until we had the basics nailed down, right? We did have this period where we just got to whatever, a dozen users and paused. And I think that's important too, you know, trying to hit the numbers prematurely sometimes is counterproductive.
So were you literally hand-to-hand combat going into shops going, this is our product, will you adopt it?
At the very start, yes. And I think that was very important because we had a direct connection with our customers. And I also learned that it wasn't as easy to sell as I thought. I thought, oh, it'd be simple. But actually, you know, I kind of gained sort of an empathy for the sales team as like how hard their job actually is. You know, even a product that seems like a clear benefit and it's easy, but you know, convincing anyone to do anything is not easy.
Yes, that's a fact.
So understand the customer, understand the sales, understand the technical challenges. I think having that really direct connection was great.
I think that's a beautiful lesson as well for founders to be on the front line, to go, even, you know, because founders, like you said, this is obvious. This is the best product in the world. But as you say, selling anything to anybody, even if it's, you know, this vitamin, you'll live to 100. You know, even trying to get that across to people is, if the benefit isn't immediate as well. But like something like Pointy, you can clearly see it works and you can clearly see the metrics. So
you need a little slice of someone's attention, right? Yeah. And people are busy. So, you know, doing anything, it's hard.
As a second time founder, what did your name open more doors? Because raising a seed fund round of 1.2 million, that's quite a chunky seed round in Ireland. Did your name open more doors, or do you think the idea was better, or what do you think worked differently this time?
No, I mean, we were definitely in a sort of privileged position in that, you know, I'd done a previous company, we had some track record, and that helped a lot. I think we probably wouldn't have been able to raise that round. And we raised it at like a healthy valuation as well. We were quite, you know, sort of stringent on that. We said no to plenty of investors who didn't want to meet our terms. So I think we were in a much stronger position. Now, it wasn't easy. Like, it still took months to put the seed round together, and you know, I probably took, you know, 5 meetings for every person who's, you know, everyone who said yes or something, you know. So it wasn't one of these things where the round came together in a week. Definitely was a lot of legwork, but at the same time, it was, I think, probably would have been unachievable, well, not unachievable, but much harder for you know, somebody who was coming at this totally fresh. Although people do it, you know, there are examples. You know, Shane Curran, I think, for Evervault would be an example of, you know, Irish founder, you know, just fresh out of college, or, you know, he was a college dropout, and like he raised a very impressive round. So, you know, I think those examples do exist. So I wouldn't want to tell people that can't be done. It definitely can be done.
As Pointy began to scale then, at what point did you kind of go, this might be a sale again, or was that even on your horizon, or how did that come to pass?
I mean, I think you always, to some extent, are, you know, you're always riding all the horses to some extent in the sense that, like, when you're raising around, you know, you're also thinking about, you know, what does this do to our, you know, sometimes you can, like, if you got offered a raise at, you know, $1 billion, you know, and your company was a year old, like, you know, some of that stuff has been happening recently, like, you know, that sort of locks you into a certain path, right? You know, you say, well, okay, we're going to take this money now, but like, we're basically committed to IPOing, whereas if you raise at lower valuation, sometimes you kind of have, you know, there are different potential exit options. So we certainly, you know, you think about it, you think about your options a little bit. You have commercial partnerships with the company, you know, sometimes those things become acquisitions. You're kind of like, you know, I think you'd be remiss as a entrepreneur or as a board not to kind of always have all those things in mind. Now, I know there are some entrepreneurs who'd be like, you know, definitively, you know, this company is only going to IPO, and that's like, you know, everything else is off the table. And I think that's actually very clarifying and very admirable. But, you know, that's not every company necessarily, you know, is going to follow that trajectory. I mean, if you just look at the statistics, most won't. And some are, you know, so we would, I think building a company in order to be acquired is a terrible idea, but, you know, keeping your options open and being, you know, aware of the different paths you could follow, you know, you're either going to, you know, IPO, be acquired, you know, have a PE exit, or, you know, fail, basically. Or, I mean, it could sort of turn into a lifestyle business, right? So there's a number of, you just have to, you know, weigh all these things up, and at every kind of fork in the road, you know, and that tends to be kind of the next time you're raising a round or, you know, something like that. You just kind of try and ride all the different horses at once and see which one looks the best in a given time, basically.
Did it feel like deja vu? Did you feel like, oh, this has happened exactly like this before? What was that feeling of?
It was a bit weird. Yeah, it wasn't like, yeah, it was slightly weird. Yeah, I wasn't expecting it. One thing that was kind of funny was that they sent us when the acquisition process was going on, they sent us a due diligence checklist, and I think it was the same Excel file that sent me like 10 years previously. Like, yeah, it was the same. So, yeah,
they're checking their HR, going, hey, this guy, I think we've had someone of this name before work here.
That was slightly weird for sure. Yeah.
So happens again. Okay, you have a sale. Slightly different this time. It was definitely more public. It was definitely seemed to be like it made a big splash. I remember it happening at the time. I remember it was all across the papers. What did that feel like?
Yeah, like you said, it was a very different beast. Like we were much, you know, last time it was a two-person company. This time we were close to 100 people, I think. It was 90-something people at the time of the acquisition. And it was, it was more complicated because, like you say, it was sort of in the newspapers. We had a bit more of a public presence. Like we were, you know, thinking, you know, but basically trying to land. We were very heads down, I think, in the detail of trying to get the deal across the line. You're some working till 3 a.m. sometimes with lawyers, you know, trying to get this stuff to happen. There's always kind of funky edge cases where you're trying to chase down, you know, a final signature from an investor who's gone, you know, on holidays for months or, you know, whatever. There's always something that you're trying to do to get the deal across the line. So it's stressful. And I think you kind of almost collapse across the finish line in many cases. I thought basically it was, I think we were very positive. It was a good outcome for our team. Our team were very happy. It was a good outcome for our investors. You know, it was good for, the founders. So we thought Google was a good fit, you know, in the sense that they had a shared vision for, you know, what we wanted to do. And, you know, the product is still there and still growing. You know, I think sometimes you get acquisitions where the product is acquired and kind of effectively shut down or kind of left to wither. And that would have been very sad. Like, you know, we all put our blood, sweat and tears into building this and believed in this. And so and they also left the team in Dublin, which is something that, you know, sometimes you're going to have to like move everyone wholesale to the other side of the world. And you've got a lot of people's lives to uproot and stuff. And so I think on a lot of metrics, like the deal just made sense. It was a good sort of outcome for everyone around the table. And it was obviously good for Google as well, in that the product fit nicely. So we were pretty happy with the outcome.
I've asked this question to nearly every founder that's had like a sizable exit, and I've almost stopped asking it because they don't have the benefit of the vision of seeing it a couple of years later. I've chatted to founders who've sold and I've been chatting to them very recently, and it hasn't sunk in yet. Is there a point whereby it kind of hits home that it's happened and this has changed, you know, your lives and the lives of people around you? Is there a point, I know you went straight back to work for Google again. Is there a point where you kind of wake up and go, okay, this is a good feeling?
Yeah, I mean, the initial feeling is sort of just intensity, basically, because you're trying to get the deal across the line. And then actually, after the acquisition closed, like inside Google, COVID hit a few weeks later. And so had to like rethink all of the processes of the company. And it was actually probably, you know, I thought after the deal closed, we can kind of relax a little bit. But it was actually the opposite. It was one of the most stressful and intense work periods probably of the whole company was that year, 2020, because, you know, we just had to try and keep the show on the road through huge changes. So definitely had no time to reflect on it then. But now I suppose, you know, I was at Google for 2 years to kind of basically, you know, make sure everything went smoothly and was well integrated and the team was all bedded in. And, you know, most of the, like, vast majority of the team are still there. And I've just left Google a few months ago. And it kind of then was really when I had a bit of time to reflect on us. And yeah, I mean, I think I am, in retrospect, I feel like we made, a good deal that worked out well for everyone. So I was pretty happy.
What is it, once, twice, three times a lady? Are we going to go again?
I have no idea. I mean, the first time around, I thought I'd never do that again. And the second time, I thought, well, probably not going to do that again, but you never know.
I have a funny feeling we might be doing this pod again in about
maybe
4 years.
Birth. Not that I've experienced giving birth. But, yeah.
It's so, right. What you've seen kind of every element of the Irish ecosystem. It's been a crazy 2 years, 2022. If you were an entrepreneur starting again in 2022, which I feel you might, what would your advice be? What would your kind of like, okay, I'm going to distill all these lessons into, right, when you're starting in 2022, here's what I would do.
So I think the most salient thing about 2022 is that it's potentially a down market, like a bear market. And I think we haven't really experienced that since 2008, 2009. And that's a very different dynamic, but it can actually be a very positive dynamic, you know. So like the risk, like every market cycle or every stage of a market cycle has its risks. And like the stage that we've just come out of was the, you know, kind of top of the, I don't want to call it the bubble because I'm not sure it was exactly a bubble, but the top of the mania or the top of the bull market.
It's possible to know what to call it.
And you saw like companies getting very, yeah, but you saw companies getting very, very, very extreme valuations very quickly. And that has its, that comes with its own problems, right? You know, that you have these very high expectations you need to meet. You know, if the market turns, you know, trying to raise again at that valuation, you might have a down round. It's tough on the company. You might have grown too quickly. You might have tried to chase metrics that are the wrong metrics, like trying to chase revenue or bad growth when actually you needed to be kind of nailing down some internal KPIs first or something. So, and now we're into kind of what looks like it'll probably be a down market. I don't think anyone really knows, but it looks like we've definitely pulled back from that peak. And so, you know, you have a different set of problems and that funding is maybe a little harder to guess. But I think the perks of being in a market like this, if you want to call it that, you know, customers are harder to get, but, you know, there's probably going to be a bit less competition for talent, you know, because the companies that might have otherwise been funded maybe aren't so much. You know, you can pick up people who are maybe leaving from companies that might be letting people go. You probably have a bit more time in that, like, you know, you're trying to focus on more sensible metrics, you know, like less crazy growth, maybe a bit more sort of sustainable growth. And like, it's a bit of a cliche, but a lot of the best companies are built in a kind of down market. And, you know, a company takes a long time to build. It takes, you know, a decade roughly. And a decade from now, you know, who knows what the market conditions will be like. So, you know, you can pick your time for your, you know, exit, whatever that might be, an IPO or an acquisition or whatever. And that's going to be in a very different kind of market cycle. So, you know, it's actually probably an excellent time to start right now. You know, if you can make it work, which is, you know, maybe a little harder, but maybe in some ways easier.
I think that's a great point. You know, people, if you listen to the narrative, oh, fear, you know, oh, be careful, oh, recession, oh, inflation. If you listen to that, you'd never do anything. But like you say, if you're able to project yourself forward 10 years, what can you achieve in those 10 years? You'll probably have a few different ups and downs in the economy in those 10 years. So if you can just stay level and stay moving, I think it's incredible advice for someone starting in 2022. Don't think of 2022, think of the next 10 years.
Yeah, and you'll experience every kind of thing along the way. Like, I mean, people don't even remember now, but I think when we were raising our round in 2016, there was like the taper tantrum. There was like this tiny little wobble in the market that I think everyone's forgotten about. But, you know, there was a sort of 3-month period where all the investors were kind of pulling back into their shells a bit. And we were trying to raise our round at exactly that point. It was really hard. So, you know, even when, like, you get these little micro kind of fluctuations that can, because, you know, as a startup, you have to raise in a fairly narrow window of time sometimes. So, you know, those, you know, the macro story sometimes it doesn't matter so much as it's about like what's happening in, you know, right around you in maybe fairly specific circumstances or specific periods of time. But yeah.
There's a massive recency bias there as well. You're obviously a man who keeps an eye on trends, thinks deeply about industries. Is there any industries or trends you're looking at right now going, oh, there's definitely potential there. There's definitely a bit of opportunity there. Is there any of those industries you're looking at right now thinking that there's potential?
I mean, the one that jumps out to me by far is sort of like AI and machine learning. You know, that is my background, so maybe I'm a little biased, but you see a lot of the stuff that, you know, OpenAI is doing with GPT-3 and DALL-E and so on, and the work that, you know, DeepMind is doing, you know, Google, Facebook, et cetera. I think those are really transformative technologies that are just reaching the point where, you know, they're just on the cusp of being, you know, viable to do interesting things with. And I think there's going to be an entire generation of startups built around all that. So that's pretty exciting. And that's kind of accessible, I think. There's others that I'm excited about that are a bit less accessible. You know, I think robotics will be big, but maybe it's a little further out. You know, there's a lot of stuff happening that's interesting in, you know, some like biotech and, you know, applying sort of information, like, you know, computation to biology in general, but like that's a little harder. You know, climate, there's some genuine sort of, you know, stuff starting to happen in like you know, clean energy transition. But again, it's pretty capital intensive. It's a little harder to access, but not impossible. I actually think that we may have like a breakthrough in fusion. You have a lot of fusion companies, but again, it's pretty rarefied. So I think the one that's most interesting to me is probably AI. We're at an interesting moment where, like, you know, we've had this, the last big change was maybe the iPhone or mobile. And then there's been this period where, like, you know, stuff has been kind of brewing, but nothing has really exploded out yet. And I think we're maybe kind of about to see the next few things emerge. So that's the best time to be an entrepreneur, when something, a new platform has just come out or a new technology that you can really run with, because, you know, the incumbents generally are much slower to leverage anything like that than you know, nimble startups. So.
That's a really good point. I think there's been a lot of kind of gradual increments, you know, iPhone 12, iPhone 13, you're kind of going, oh, it's got a better camera. Cool. You know, there's very little kind of stuff you go, oh, that's really changed X. So I think it will be cool when you do have massive leaps. And I think, like you said, it'll be a great time. Are you tempted to get back into the investing game?
I do some angel investing, just, you know, in general, like, you know, not a whole lot, but I do, you know, a few every year. I also actually have invested a bit in some venture capital funds. So I'd be an investor in the fund who would then invest in startups. So, yeah.
Perfect. One final question before I let you go. Is there a book that's kind of shaped your journey or had an impact on you personally or professionally?
So I think early on when I was doing my first company, a book I really enjoyed was Founders at Work, Jessica Livingstone, which is, at this point, it's almost like a work of history. I mean, it's really about companies being founded in the 1990s, which is a very different environment. But still hearing the founder, it's basically, it's a series of interviews with founders. And so just hearing the founder's stories directly, not through any kind of lens or filter, I found... Just, I got a lot out of it, just in terms of sort of inspiration, and also kind of some sort of soft knowledge about, you know, how the industry works. The other one I'd recommend is much more tactical. It's a book called The High Growth Handbook by Elad Gil.
I've heard of this, but I haven't read
it. It's not. It's more like a reference book, like where you don't read it cover to cover, but like you sort of dip into it, and so it's very tactical about, like, you know, how do you recruit a good board member, or how do you run a, you know, how do you optimize growth, or how do you deal with, like, you know, executive hiring, or, you know, it's very, it's kind of a playbook basically for, you know, received wisdom on how to run a good startup. And it's pretty good.
Brilliant. First time recommended as well. That's brilliant. Yeah. Mark, where can people get in touch with you or follow you?
Probably on Twitter. I think Mark_Cummins. Probably the best place.
Perfect. That's where I found you anyway, so worked for me. Listen, Mark, thank you so much. That was an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Gary. Good talking. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Mark. If you want to hear more, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or on YouTube. I'll see you here next Monday.